And welcome to Story Junkies, where we talk movies, books, and television because we're addicted to story. I'm author Pete Bauer, and this is my co-host, Baby Falcon.
And yes, people really do call me that.
Yes, they do. On purpose, sometimes.
Sometimes?
I'm just kidding.
Okay. How
would they do it accidentally?
How would they do it accidentally?
Who knows? It's a big world. It's a mystery.
You're the writer. I think you should work on that.
I'll think of an idea. Okay, so today we're talking about Hitchcock's classic, The Birds.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, so it's a pretty amazing movie, stylized for its time, but it has some really interesting approaches to how to tell a story effectively.
I remember watching this movie when I was a little girl with my dad, and I was so amazed at all of the different things that Hitch did to put the audience in place of the characters. That really is such a unique strength to his directorial style, and it's definitely on display in The Birds.
He is really amazing at understanding what people want, and then he decides when to give it to them and when not to, and that's where all of his suspense and craftsmanship come in, so it's pretty amazing. Before we delve into plot and character, I think it's important to do a little level setting, explaining the story structure used for all stories, and later we'll also talk about scenes that are required in thrillers to satisfy the audience. But first, let me describe the story structure. Some people like to use a three-act structure, and others break the second act, which is very long, into two parts, thereby making a four-act structure. And since this is a podcast and we can't use visuals, I think for clarity's sake, we'll use the four-act structure for the show. So, Act 1 begins with an inciting incident, which is an event that hooks the reader or viewer into the story, thrusting the protagonist into the main action. After the inciting incident, we then delve into the main character's lives to understand how they normally live and work before everything goes to hell in a handbasket. So at the end of Act 1 is what's called a plot point, and this is a major incident or event that occurs and changes the direction of the main character and propels them into the rest of the story. Their entire life is thrown upside down. In Act 2, this is where the main characters must face and overcome obstacles, reacting to the forces opposing them, trying to survive while they gather information to understand what they are up against. Every obstacle grows more difficult from the last. The big difference between Acts 2 and 3 is Act 2, the main characters are in reactive mode, and in Act 3, they're in proactive mode. After Act 2 is the midpoint or middle of the movie, and this is where something as major as the first plot point occurs. But unlike that event, this midpoint doesn't change the direction of the story or the character's path, it simply propels them into proactive mode. Act 3 is where the main characters become proactive and begin to take action against the opposing forces. They try to take control and use their knowledge and experience, having overcome all that they've already faced, to move forward toward a final confrontation. At the end of Act 3 is another major incident, another plot point, where it once again changes the direction of the story and propels the main characters into the final act. And in Act 4, this is the final battle. In this act, the characters overcome their most difficult obstacles until they can face the villain, confront them, and ultimately defeat them. So, that's the four-act structure that every story uses. And television can be a little different because of commercial breaks, but it's generally the same.
So two questions. One, have you ever seen a successful story that doesn't really abide by this established story structure?
Yes and no. And the reason I say that is that in movies, each act is a specific amount of time. In this example, each act would be 30 minutes long. In the three-act structure, it would be 30 minutes for Act 1, 60 minutes for Act 2, and 30 minutes for Act 3. If you did the three-act structure, all of them ending up about 120 minutes. I haven't seen anyone not use a three-act or four-act structure, but Steven Spielberg in Close Encounters used a three-act structure where instead of it being 30 minutes, 60 minutes, 30 minutes, each close encounter had equal time. So it was 40 minutes, 40 minutes, 40 minutes.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it actually felt long. The way this structure works, it's not something people made up. It's just something people became aware of that we like, I think, over time. And we've been telling stories as a species for, you know, ever.
Well, and that's something you've experienced yourself as a writer with breaking existing story molds and then kind of having to go back and rework stuff.
Yeah, because you have to meet the audience's or the reader's expectation or it's incomplete. And there have been times where I've written something where people will like it but not recommend it because I did not meet all of their expectations. And I'll go over those expectations specific to thrillers at the end. But anyway, that's the four-act structure. What's your second question?
How does the four-act structure play into The Birds?
Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so let's talk about The Birds then.
Let's do it.
While we're here.
I mean, right? Yeah. We just wanted to do an introduction and then say, go watch the film, but I guess we'll talk about it.
That's a good approach, I think.
I think so. Yeah. Yesterday I watched a movie. You should too. Thank you. Please subscribe. That's right.
We would change the show to Story Introductions. This is a movie, and this is what it's about. It's like an audio trailer.
Ooh, I like that.
Okay, so let's talk about The Birds. I'll go through a synopsis of each act, and then we can talk about it in regards to plot and character and so forth. Act 1, the movie takes place, I think, in like 62, 63, somewhere in that time. The movie starts in San Francisco, and Melanie Daniels, played by Tippi Hedren, is beautiful, smart, and charming. She goes to a bird store to pick up a bird she had ordered, and runs into Mitch Brenner, played by Rod Taylor, who is a San Francisco lawyer, and he's handsome, smart, and charming. They're both smart and charming.
Good for them.
Must be good to be them. She acts like she works there, and he acts like he believes her, and they have this flirtatious conversation about him wanting to buy a pair of lovebirds for his younger sister's birthday. Mitch finally reveals that he knows who Melanie is. She's the privileged child of the owner of the newspaper and is both spoiled and misunderstood. He tells her, "It's time to go back into your gilded cage, Melanie Daniels."
She's also a very big prankster.
She is. I love her character because she's like, she will not give up. Mm-hmm. She will not be had. She is relentless in a very funny way. So he leaves. Mitch leaves the bird store, but as we just said, she can't let that stand. So she buys the lovebirds and goes to drop them off at his apartment. However, he's not there. She finds out that he's gone to his family home in Bodega Bay, which is about 90 minutes north of San Francisco. So she drives up to Bodega Bay with the birds to find out Mitch's sister's name, talks with a man running a local hardware store, and I love that store, by the way, and meets Annie Hayworth, who is the town teacher. She lets Melanie know that Mitch's sister is named Kathy. Melanie rents a small boat from the marina, travels across the bay. She spots Mitch working in a barn next to his house, so she turns off the engine and rows the boat to the dock, sneaks into the back of the house, drops off the lovebirds with a card for Kathy, then sneaks back out. As she starts back across the bay, Mitch goes inside the house. We only see this from Melanie's point of view, but obviously, having seen the birds, he rushes out and spots her smiling and laughing in the boat. He gets in his car, because he can't also be had, so he gets in the car, races around the edge of the bay in order to beat her back to the marina, and at 25 minutes into the film, as Melanie reaches the marina, a seagull hits her in the forehead, causing her to bleed. Mitch helps a dazed Melanie out of the boat, and then they go to a nearby restaurant to get her wound cared for. And that is the end of Act 1.
I really love Tippi Hedren's character in this movie. She is such a unique kind of figure that you get to see. I love how much of a prankster she is. And it's interesting because I've seen other people comment on her going all the way to his house, which is a bit excessive.
and a bit creepy by today's standards, actually.
For one slight. But the movie opens by him saying, "Your prank broke a plate glass window." So I think it's fair to say this is just what she does.
Yeah, and as you explore her character and her like relentless nature, you get where, as a public figure, as the rich daughter of a rich man, you could see where her pranks, some of the things that are claimed about her would be real because she's a prankster, and some of the things claimed about her would not be real because she's a rich daughter. So you kind of get that pretty quickly once you see how she just won't give up. I mean, she goes into this fishing town wearing a fur coat, a very nice dress, high heels, driving a sports car, and she's walking around like, I don't care. Right? I have to get this prank done. It's really, really funny.
And that's what I think is so fascinating about her, because she has a lot of airs about her, but not a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for?
She's not prissy or stuck up or anything like that.
Yeah, she's not stuck up or arrogant or pretentious. She just walks in and she's like, "I have a prank and you've been very kind and thank you so much for your help."
Yes.
And that's all you need to know.
Yeah. Now, I want to go just a little bit to before the movie starts, because during the opening credits, we only hear birds chirping. but they're synthesized, which makes them uncomfortable. They're birds chirping, but not the birds we hear because they're manipulated. And what's amazing about this film is that Hitchcock doesn't have a soundtrack in this movie.
Which was so powerful. I made a note of that as well. You're experiencing the film as the characters who are in the movie are experiencing the film. There's nothing to draw you out of it to say this is a movie. Everything is quiet and it's just happening as it happens.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that silence, because the birds represent danger, silence ends up being comforting. And then at the end of the movie, silence ends up being uncomfortable, which is really, really cool. Some interesting thoughts about how Hitchcock structures this story. He's known as the master of suspense. So if you're going to see a Hitchcock movie, and again, this is made before times where you could have access to a lot of information about a movie. All you knew is that Hitchcock, who's a master of suspense, made a movie about birds. Hitchcock knows that expectation going in. So it opens in a bird shop. It's going to make some people uncomfortable because what's Hitchcock going to do with all these birds, right?
That's a really big question for me with the film. As I was rewatching it for this podcast, I kept asking myself how much of this would be suspenseful if it weren't a Hitchcock film.
Right. Like, no, that is a very good point.
How much of this would be like you're in a bird shop? Honestly, the first half of the movie is like a romantic comedy from the 1960s.
It is, exactly.
But there's a sense of dread, and I think a large part of it comes from the fact that everybody there knows it's a Hitchcock film.
Right. And the way with really good film directors or novel, if you're reading a really good novel, you don't really know you're reading. It's written so well and crafted so well that you just kind of absorb it. And you're like, wow, I read that whole book. I didn't even think about it. When you watch a film that's directed by a master filmmaker, they're doing things that you're not aware of consciously, but you're subconsciously aware of it. And you kind of know, man, something's going on here, right? Like, you don't know how. You don't know how he's framing the shot or she's framing the shot. You don't know how the director's doing that or what exactly they're doing. But it's like when you watch a David Fincher film, you know something creepy is happening. And with Hitchcock, he's able to create a sense of dread just by the way he crafts the story visually. And it's not overt, because I think if it were made by another director, it wouldn't have the same effect now or then because of the way that he actually creates and frames that story and sets up the shots.
Well, and a really good example of that actually is during the prank when Melanie sneaks off into his house and she is going up and then she puts the birds in the house and then she comes back. She's going down the dock and toward the boat. He actually films her from behind and she looks back constantly to see if Mitch has spotted her or he's going into the house. But there's something very discomforting about being behind somebody, particularly in film and particularly in a Hitchcock film. You always think somebody's going to come up behind them. It's a very close shot where she's just walking back to the boat. But because you're not seeing her face or her expressions or what the surrounding scenery is like, there's a sense of discomfort. And actually, it was surprising to me because I remember noticing my discomfort in that part of the film. Like, this hasn't even started yet.
Right. Nothing scary is happening. This is where Hitchcock is using his ability to manipulate people. Because what do you want to see as the audience? You want to make sure she gets out okay. She looks back to where you want to see, and Hitchcock doesn't let you see what she sees.
That's true.
Right? So you're like, well, I want to turn around. He doesn't do a wide shot, so you're not really sure exactly where she is and geographically, clearly. And so that's how, again, a simple way he manipulates the audience. And he does this all the time.
That's such a great point to make because it happens kind of similar, but in an opposite way later on in the film where the audience knows more than the character. So in that moment, Melanie knows that she's safe because whatever she's seen indicates that she's safe, but we don't know that she's safe.
Right.
Whereas later on, Melanie's in danger and we know that she's in danger, but she doesn't know that she's in danger. And so Hitch is just so great about manipulating.
He's like, I know what you want to see. I'm not going to give it to you. He's so good at manipulating people. What's interesting too is in the first act, he quickly, as we talked about, quickly establishes the characters, their personalities, their confidence, their tenacity, and their sexual tension. What I also found interesting is that when Melanie arrives in Bodega Bay, she gives the audience the geography of the town by trying to find out who Kathy is. Because we've never been here as an audience. And we need to know later on when all the things start to happen, where it's happening so we know the relative danger to the main characters.
Where are the houses? Where's the school? Where's the docks?
Where's the restaurant? Yeah. Yes, the whole thing, right?
Were people really that trusting in the 60s? Because if someone came to me and said, what's this family's child's name? I'd be like, who are you?
Let me call the FBI and get back. No, so it's a very different time, right? Because yeah, there's a lot more crazy, nutty, sad, broken people out there. I that's what I watched too. I'm like, you can't just go into a town going, and where do they live? Oh, they live over there. How do I get to them? Oh, where's the back door to the house?
Yeah.
Oh, you go through the, you go over across the water.
This is why it had to be played by an attractive woman.
Right.
Like, full disclosure, full stop. That's why Tippi Hedren had to be cast in this role.
And what I like too is when she's talking to the hardware, I love the hardware store. It is adorable because it is small and it's packed full of stuff. And the color, the film stock he uses is very rich. And it's just all the colors of all the stuff in the hardware stores is really visually cool. But what's funny is that she's asking the name and he's trying to figure out, he can't remember the name of Mitch's sister. And so he asked a coworker, and Hitchcock just shows a bunch of shelves because the guy's in the back somewhere. He's like, hey, do you remember Kathy's name? And you just hear this voice and they have this conversation and you never see the other guy. And that's like Hitch's little sense of humor.
And that's a good example of how sometimes not seeing something doesn't really add to the suspense, because there's nothing in that scene that makes you go, who is he? Where is he? Why can't I see his face? You're just enjoying the conversation.
And if you've ever been in a small hardware store, it's like that. It's so cramped that you're like, there could be someone two rows down from you. Stuff's packed all the way to the ceiling. You don't know.
You lose your mom. You play Marco Polo. There's an established process.
And finally, he fills in the gap. So he has this opening tension of, I'm Alfred Hitchcock. This is a movie about the birds. I'm going to put you in a bird shop. And then the first attack doesn't happen for 25 minutes. So he fills that suspenseful tension of dread and horror with sexual and flirtatious tension between Melanie and Mitch. So it's a whole cat and mouse game. And what's funny, too, is that Melanie thinks she can talk her way out of anything. You know what I mean? Like, the whole time she keeps getting caught. Every time, because Mitch is a good player of this game, right?
Well, he's a lawyer.
Right, right. So she'll be like, well, I'm doing this. He'll be like, really? And then she'll just make crap up, and he knows she's lying. But she just will not give in. She's like, I'm not going to be defeated by this guy.
Well, you see his conversations with a lot of people, and he very much acts like a lawyer throughout the film. Like, he's always probing and questioning. And
right.
And he's very cocky about it.
He is. He's very, very confident. But in a very funny way, they're perfect for each other.
Right? Oh, completely.
Right. So that flirtatious relationship, which is only about 20 minutes long, everything we talked about character-wise, you understand just by the way they've constructed that first act.
Something else that I noticed about Melanie's character throughout the film is that she is, in addition to being witty and fun and very much a modern woman of the 60s, she is incredibly observant. She's the first person to notice anything. If
right.
you actually like look at her
in the crisis situations, yeah.
In the crisis situations, she notices when the birds are coming and other people are talking. She notices when the gas is spilling. She notices when Mitch's mother Lydia is acting weird. She notices everything first. She's a highly observant person, and I think that gives her a level of competence in the story, even though she's such an outsider.
She's very resilient, too. She just comes up with solutions. It's just a really good character. For a 60s movie where they don't generally invest a lot of time in characters, because it was like, this is before the method acting approach, like Marlon Brando and all that real world acting style.
Yeah, the acting in this film is still very stylized.
Right, but it works, I think, in this case. All right, now let's go on to Act Two. Act Two, this is after the bird attack, and a lot of things happen in Act Two that are building on the tension and the threat from the birds. So let's go through it. While at the restaurant, Melanie meets Lydia, Mitch's mother, for the first time, and you can tell that Lydia is suspicious of her son and the pretty rich girl who is in the small fishing town. Mitch invites Melanie to dinner, and then Melanie goes to Annie to rent a room in her house for the night. At 31 minutes, Melanie and Annie talk on the front porch, and Annie looks up and points at a large group of birds flying in the sky. Before all the mayhem happens, Hitchcock has to go, I know you're waiting for birds. I know it's about birds. I get this. So he keeps seeding small escalating bird moments so that we know he knows this is all about birds. Melanie goes to dinner with Mitch's family and meets Kathy for the first time, who thanks her for her caged love birds. Melanie plays the piano after dinner as everyone talks, which shows she's not just a pretty face, she's talented and she's graceful. When alone with Melanie, Kathy invites her to her birthday party, which is the next day. And at 40 minutes, Melanie leaves and heads back to Annie's for the night. Before going inside, Mitch notices the power lines are covered with black crows.
I actually want to make a character note there. As Melanie is leaving, Mitch kind of confronts her about one of these sensationalist stories about her and gives her a hard time about it. It's very flirtatious with her, asks her out on a date. And something really interesting happens, because up until this point in their relationship, there's been a lot of witty back and forth, a lot of bantering, but it's been a game.
Right.
And in that moment, she answers every question honestly. Her character is fairly honest. And when Annie asks her what the birds are in the car, she's like, they're lovebirds. And I know what you're going to think by me telling you that, but I don't care. But when she talks to Mitch about this story that's been written about her, and he's kind of jokingly giving her a hard time about it, she just answers very honestly and then angrily kind of drives off because he's being kind of a jerk. And it's really interesting for him as a character perspective, because he's a lawyer and he's a criminal defense lawyer. So he's confronted with lies and sensationalist stories all the time. And in that moment where he's confronted with just unapologetic honesty, like there's a line in there, he's saying, oh, you're just a poor, innocent victim. And she says, I'm neither poor nor innocent, but I didn't do this one thing.
Right.
That's such a great moment. And he kind of feels bad afterward. Like, you can see it on his face. He's like, that conversation didn't go the way I wanted it to. He was very affected by her honesty and just complete vulnerability there. And I think that's one of the big reasons that when she gets back to Annie's, he calls and apologizes and says, please stay for the birthday party, because just who she is affects him. And that honesty affects him because he's just constantly confronted with lies.
So that night at Annie's house, she tells Melanie about her history and true feelings for Mitch. They dated years earlier when they both worked in San Francisco. Unfortunately, it was right after Mitch's father died. Lydia was afraid of being alone and was a wedge between Mitch and Annie. Melanie now has understood why Lydia has been so cold to her. Annie also admits that she stayed around and became the town's teacher in the hopes of her relationship with Mitch would rekindle, but it never happened. Now she just stays there to be close to him. At 47 minutes, just before Melanie heads off to bed, a thump is heard on the door. Annie opens it to find a dead bird on her porch, killed by the impact. They're confused, as the night had a full moon and the bird wouldn't have hit her house accidentally. The next day is Kathy's birthday. Along with Mitch and Melanie, Lydia and Annie are there with other children. On a walk near the house, Melanie confides that her mother left her when she was a child, and she feels abandoned. At 52 minutes into the movie, a flock of seagulls, and that's not the 80s band, because that would be a very different movie, a flock of seagulls attacks the kids at their outdoor birthday party.
I would have loved to have seen that hairstyle there, though.
That would have been awkward.
On Mitch.
Mitch, Melanie, and Annie save everyone and get the kids inside. After the party, Mitch asks Melanie to stay for dinner. Lydia doesn't want her to stay, but Kathy pleads and gets her way. At 56 minutes, a flock of small birds, I think they're sparrows, I'm not sure, I don't remember, fly down the chimney and attack everyone in the house. Eventually, they fight them off and the birds escape back through the chimney. A local cop arrives, and as Mitch explains what happened, Melanie and us, through her eyes, watch Lydia, who looks like she's in shock, as she picks up broken teacups and plates trying to clean up. The cop tries to explain away the attack and mentions a neighbor, Dan, was having trouble with his chickens because they wouldn't eat. That matched Lydia's problem with her own chickens, but they don't feel this has anything to do with the bird attack.
They're not hungry for food anymore.
They want human flesh. So the cop leaves unconvinced, and the next morning, Lydia searches for answers by going to Dan's house to ask about his chickens. Dan has not been seen since the night before when they were attacked by birds. Lydia enters the house to find a set of teacups hanging on hooks in the kitchen, broken, like her own cups after the bird attack.
Which, just to interject real quick, is a really great moment for Lydia, because that's a thing that I think Lydia specifically would uniquely notice, because she did take the time to clean up. So seeing broken teacups would, to her, indicate something happened.
Yes.
Whereas it probably wouldn't have to Mitch.
At 60 minutes, she finds Dan in his bedroom, which is a mess, and dead birds are stuck in broken window glass. And Dan is on the floor, dead, leaning against the wall, covered in wounds, and his eyes have been plucked from his head. Lydia races home and tells Mitch and Melanie. Mitch calls the police and goes over to Dan's house to check it out. Melanie stays back to care for Lydia. They have a bonding moment. Lydia shares her loss at missing her dead husband and her fear of being abandoned, a feeling which Melanie is all too keenly aware of. Melanie also gets to take care of a mother figure, and during the conversation, Lydia repeatedly asks Melanie if Kathy is safe at school, as the school has large windows. Melanie agrees to go to the school to get Kathy and bring her back home. Before she leaves, Lydia calls Melanie by her first name for the first time. This begins the midpoint of the movie. At 68 minutes, the scene at the schoolhouse begins, and this is Hitchcock doing his best work. Melanie goes to the school and peeks in to see Annie teaching the kids a song. As she waits outside, she sits on a bench, her back to a playground behind her with a large metal jungle gym. While Melanie smokes, unbeknownst to her, crows slowly fly in and land on the jungle gym. One, then another in a consistent cadence. Melanie then spots a crow in the sky and cowers, afraid of the lone bird. She follows the bird to its landing spot on the jungle gym, except it isn't just a few birds as you would expect. Every spot on the jungle gym, power lines, and roof are covered with black crows. Melanie carefully goes back into the school and warns Annie. Annie tells the kids they're going to show Melanie a fire drill and that they are to leave the school quietly, and when she tells them, they are to run home if it's close or to the restaurant at the bottom of the hill. As the kids leave, we are stuck watching the birds on the jungle gym, wondering how far the children have gone.
Which, not to interrupt Hitchcock's suspense, this plan to get the kids to safety was absolutely horrible. They could have walked silently
the whole way, then
run if the birds attack.
No, I know.
But they storm out of the school like a bat out of hell.
That is true. Well, they walk for a while, and then suddenly you hear the feet running on the pavement, and at 74 minutes, the sound of the children running propels the crows into action.
Uh-huh.
It's a problem. And they attack the children. Crows knock kids to the ground. They peck on their hands, backs, necks, and faces. Melanie pulls two kids into a parked station wagon and rolls up the windows as the others run for cover. And eventually, the crows take off and are gone as quickly as they arrive. And that is the end of the midpoint, which is the end of Act 2.
Dun, dun, dun.
So what I like about this is you can really start to feel the screws. Just like, oh, gosh, there seems to be a lot of birds in the sky. That's weird. And then, oh, a bird just hit our door. And then, oh my gosh, they just attacked us at a birthday party. Oh my gosh, they came through the window. Oh my gosh, they just attacked a school full of children. Like, everything is amped up and you're like, what is going to happen next, right? It's a great escalation of suspense and consequence.
And I think that's a great way to describe it because it's not like some of his other films, like for example, Psycho, where suddenly you're stabbed. You know,
right.
It's not like you were expecting one thing and then got something completely different. You go into it knowing that something's going to happen with birds. And so he really does slowly tighten the screw because it's also a very slow-paced film.
Right.
It occurs very much in natural time for the people who are living in the story.
And if you can effectively create a sense of dread, then slow is good because you're like, oh, something bad's going to happen. If he does not effectively create a sense of dread, then it's just slow, which is a bad movie. I don't know how they do it. I don't know how filmmakers create a sense of dread, but when they do, it's extending the torture, you know what I mean, for the audience. They've been reactive up to this point. Birds are attacking, they don't know why, and they're just like trying to figure this out. And this is the catalyst where they go, we have to figure out what to do. This is where it goes into Act 3, which is where the main characters become proactive and start trying to defend or attack or fight it if they can. And what's interesting, too, is that as each bird attack gets more bold, the birds seem directly interested in Melanie. Because she's at the center of all the attacks.
Well, at least that's how it appears.
Because she wasn't at the guy's house.
Well, and there also was stories and reports later on in the film on the radio of other towns that birds were attacking.
Right, but she seemed to be the catalyst, right? She shows up with the caged lovebirds. And then she gets attacked by a gull. And then the bird hits the door where she is. And then they hit the party where she is. And then they're in the house where she is. And then they're at the school where she is.
Well, it actually seems directly tied to her relationship with Mitch. Because the bird only runs into Annie's door when Melanie decides to go to the party. She was planning on leaving. Nothing happened.
Right. These are the things that Hitchcock throws in there to make you ask questions about what is the motive of the villain. In most stories, and thrillers especially, the motive of the villain is the most important thing, right? Like, because villains always think they're doing the right thing, but we never know why the birds are doing what they're doing, which is a very bold choice, I think.
To the very end, we never find out.
It's
a mystery. And I actually think that ties into thematically the point of the story going all the way back to the source material, which was a short novella.
Right.
But that's something I know we'll get to talking about themes in a little bit. One thing I do want to say, though, is as I was preparing for today's episode, I came across this quote from a review from the Daily Telegraph. I don't know when it was written, but the writer says the true genius of the film, based on the 1952 short story by Daphne du Maurier, is the way Hitchcock makes the malevolent birds seem like manifestations of his character's mental unease.
Ah, that's interesting, because one of the things that I noticed too is that beyond the bird threat, Hitchcock also layers in personal tension, like a lot of it. There's tension between Melanie and Annie, between Melanie and Mitch's mother, between Melanie really not wanting to overstay her welcome, staying because of Kathy, right? So there's just constant tension between Melanie and either what she wants to do or the relationship she has.
And I think that kind of ties into one of the themes of the film, which is actually the role of women and gender dynamics and stuff like that, because bird is also slang for women.
Right.
And there are a lot of female characters that are very critical to the film. Annie, Melanie, Lydia. Not so much Kathy, but those three women in particular. And it's interesting because something you just said brought up in my mind that with all of the dysfunction in the relationship, so Annie had a relationship with Mitch, which was kind of broken by Lydia, because Lydia is a bird trying to protect her nest.
Right.
Like, she doesn't want anything to change. She's afraid of being abandoned. She just wants her nest to stay the way that it is. If women are different kinds of birds, Melanie is the bird, right? She comes in and she's the bird that gains all of the attention. And Annie and Lydia kind of recognize that. And it's partially because personality-wise, she's very suited to Mitch. But I think it's also because from a personal damage perspective, Melanie also has abandonment issues. So she can relate to Lydia on that level. Annie mentions when she's talking to Melanie that now that she and Mitch aren't together, Lydia and Annie have become very good friends. And there's an interesting scene where Melanie's on the phone with Mitch earlier, I think in Act Two, where a lot of the focus directorially is actually on Annie, who's just smoking and who's been very quote unquote supportive of Melanie. Like, she never gets in Melanie's way, but she obviously doesn't want what's happening to continue to happen. There's like a battle between them, competition between them over Mitch, but she's just kind of quietly acquiescing. But it's actually interesting because I think that Annie and her continuous love of Mitch kind of depends on Lydia's dysfunction to prevent other people from getting close to Mitch.
Right.
And so all of this brokenness and all of their relationships and the tension between all of these women and just how messed up all of it is almost manifested with the birds.
That's true. And it's almost unfair to Annie for Melanie to show up as beautiful, rich, and perfectly broken for Lydia.
And also, she's incredibly kind. Like, you can't even hate her because she's nice.
Yeah.
And she keeps trying to leave.
Right.
Like, and they won't let her. They won't let her.
What I also thought was interesting from a character perspective was to show the closeness between Mitch and his mother. Is after dinner in Act Two, they're doing dishes. And Mitch calls her darling, his mother. And he calls her dear. I thought that was really interesting choice of words for a son to express to a mother. It shows the distance Melanie has to travel.
Well, and Oedipus is brought up as a point in this story. They didn't go down that path. I mean, Lydia's fears aren't out of any Freudian issues, but more out of a fear of being abandoned. But Annie does mention Oedipus, and they do come across a farmer with his eyes plucked out, which is what Oedipus does to himself after he finds out he married his mom. So I think there's definitely some subtext
with
the deer and darling.
And one thing that he does visually is when Lydia goes to Dan's house before she finds his eyes plucked out, he has a long shot of her driving her truck over a dirt road to his house. What he did is he wet the road so that the truck wouldn't blow up any dirt. When Lydia sees Dan, she comes out and she's so shocked she literally can't speak. She's trying to scream and she can't.
Which plays into the use of silence in the film, which I like. But also, not every person upon coming across a dead body would scream. We usually see that in films, but sometimes you would just run and be silent and be in shock. That's a very realistic reaction.
And what he does then is when she leaves, she tears out of there in her truck. The road was then dry so that the truck plumed up all this dirt, and it was like the screaming engine was screaming for her and the dust was showing how panicked she was. And that's like a visual choice he made, where I read about that and I remember seeing it in the movie and I didn't think twice about it. But those are the thoughts that really good directors have. Is consciously we don't see the difference, but subconsciously we know something is different about that shot that fits the emotional connection he's trying to make. But then when we get to the schoolhouse thing, this is where he manipulates us so brilliantly.
Yeah, that's one of the best scenes, in probably the best scene in the film, is that is that caged bird scene.
Yeah. So Melanie sits on the bench outside the playground and we see the birds land behind her one by one, consistently, slowly. And here's the deal. At this point in this scene, we know more than she does because her back is to the birds. And so he gives you power, right? Hitchcock's like, you know more and you actually want to tell, you want to scream through the screen. Turn around, right? Birds behind you, danger, danger. When she finally spots a single crow, you think she's kind of acting silly because, oh yeah, you think that's bad, right? There's like 10 crows behind you.
It's the one time in the film she's not observant, and it really didn't work out for her.
Right. What he does then is, again, so what does he show you? When you see what she doesn't, you have power. And then he puts you in her eyes as you follow the bird. And it's this long shot of following this single crow to the jungle gym. And you think you know what you're going to see. You're going to see the 11th bird or the 15th bird, right? Because he's set up this cadence. And then when the bird lands, there's 500 birds. And now you're as shocked as she is. Now you're both back in the same spot emotionally. And what that does is immediately puts you back in her shoes. And so, because suspense is created by you having more knowledge than the main character. So it gives you that suspense, but he has to put you back into her shoes to make you identify with her. And he does that through shock. It's just brilliant. It's brilliant, brilliant filmmaking.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a scene I studied a lot when I was a kid. Just everything that Hitch did in that moment.
Let's go into Act 3. And this one goes quicker because the events are bigger. Act 3 begins at the restaurant, and Melanie calls her father to report the attack at the school. Others in the restaurant overhear their conversation. A drunkard, a skeptic, a boat captain, concerned townsfolk, a bird hater, a hobby ornithologist, and a terrified mother from out of town with her two children. Melanie explains to them that the birds just weren't attacking the children. She thinks they wanted to kill them. No one really believes Mitch or Melanie, and the panicked woman convinces the bird hater to lead her to the interstate so she can get out of town. At 84 minutes, the ornithologist scoffs at the suggestions of birds really attacking. Seconds later, outside, the birds begin another attack. Outside the restaurant, a man is filling his tank at a gas station, and he's knocked to the ground by a bird. His gas flows down the hill to a man lighting a cigarette in the restaurant parking lot. The man catches fire. His car explodes, and the fire flows up the hill to the gas pump, which also explodes. From high overhead, we see the town square, the people running, and the fire burning. Moments later, seagulls enter the frame.
Which is one of my favorite shots in the whole film.
My favorite shot in the whole movie.
Yes, and here's actually one of the reasons why. With both the original story and with the birds, I kind of got the impression that it's a little bit an allegory for war from the perspective of people and not soldiers, because there's all of these attacks happening. In the original novella, the story took place by a veteran a little bit after World War II, and so there were a lot of World War II references. When this film was made, the Cold War was going on, and so there's a lot of fear from the perspective of the people. The novella also took place in England, so they had air attacks.
Right, right,
and
yeah.
When you are just a person, not a soldier, we see so many war movies from the perspective of soldiers, but what about the people? And it literally looked to me like something I'd seen in a war movie where planes are flying in over a town. That's
right.
Just exactly what went through my mind, and it's just such a great shot. It's fantastic.
I love it. I'll go into it a little bit in a second, but let me finish the act. Melanie goes out to try to help, but gets attacked and takes refuge in a glass phone booth where the birds slam into the glass from all sides, breaking it, trying to get through. And it's funny because now she's trapped in a cage. Mitch rescues her and they go back into the restaurant. At first it appears empty, but then they find everyone hiding in the back of the building. The ornithologist cowers and won't show her face. The terrified mother blames Melanie, saying she heard the attack started when she came to town, and that she's evil. Melanie slaps her across the face. And that attack at the restaurant is plot point 2, because the bird war is now real.
It's a wartime movie without a war.
It's interesting.
It's so fascinating. Actually, I think that slap is another really big moment, I think, thematically for the point that the movie is trying to get across. If you have the impression a little bit that the movie is kind of about women a little bit, which I definitely feel like it is with the commentary that they make, Melanie has been the center of all of these different bird attacks,
right.
Even though she's been trying to be helpful. So she comes back in, she walks in with Mitch, and what's interesting is all the men are outside trying to fight off the birds. And when they walk around the hall, she is staring down an entire restaurant full of like small town women who are kind of staring at her in judgment, except for the woman who was the hobby ornithologist who has turned away from her because she was wrong. She was so adamant birds would never attack. And so she's the only one who doesn't sit in condemnation of her. Everyone else is, but silently, until that mother verbalizes what everybody is silently thinking. I think this is your fault. I think you're evil. And Melanie is so different from them. So even if these birds weren't attacking, do you think that they would think that because she's just such a different kind of bird? A bird, you know, birds of a feather stick together. She's not of their feather.
Right, right. And this is what I love about what Hitchcock does in this restaurant scene. What he does is the best movies and stories answer the questions that you're thinking of, or at least broach the questions you're thinking of as the storyteller has brought you to this moment. One of the thoughts the audience could be is that this is all Melanie's fault and she's evil. That's one thought that an audience member may have. What's really clever is that all the people in the restaurant are different perspectives that the audience may have about the cause of the birds. First, he has the ornithologist who's able to explain how the birds should act versus what Mitch and Melanie have seen them do. She gives the audience a broader perspective, like a Birds for Dummies, which shows the audience how abnormal the events are in Bodega Bay and just how great of a threat could be coming, because the ornithologist says, if different bird species decided to flock together, we wouldn't have a chance.
Which is why the guy's like, it's the end of the world.
Right. So after that, that's what we're going to next. You also have this drunkard who claims it's the biblical end of the world scenario.
Which, to be fair, the birds do swarm like locusts.
Right.
So.
And then there's the boat captain who feels that it could all be coincidence. You have the bird hater who wants all the birds dead. And, you know, some people in the audience are like, just kill them all, right? And then you have the mother who just wants to get out. And then your people in the audience going, yeah, just leave, right? Why don't you leave town?
Somewhere there's no birds.
Right.
Go to
right.
Antarctica. Well, aren't there penguins there?
Yeah, but I get your meaning. But what's really smart is that these characters all represent the things that we would be thinking in the audience. And each character is in there specifically to provide an opinion that the audience probably feels and validates for the audience. That could be a scenario. I'm not going to answer which one it is, but it could be that.
Well, and that's so important as well for the audience to actually care about the characters. One of the most unforgivable things for an audience is to watch a character that's being needlessly stupid, which
right.
is why in horror movies, they root for certain people to die. Like, don't go down into the basement. If you go down into the basement
yes.
in a horror movie, you deserve to die, right? That's the mindset. So what they're doing is they're addressing all of these different ideas. So even if they don't pursue killing all of the birds as an example, at least it's been mentioned.
Right. Yeah. Hitchcock says specifically in one of his interviews that you can't betray the audience's opinion of the main character, or else they will, he says, feel ill will toward that character. Example, when you're watching a horror movie and they're like, maybe I'll go down in the basement by myself. It's like, don't go down in the basement. And if the character decides to go down in the basement, you want them to be hurt. You're like, well, you're an idiot. You deserve to die because you shouldn't have gone down in the basement. So he's very protective of how he allows the audience to perceive the main characters. You can never put the audience in a place where they feel ill will against the main character. Another thing about this act is when they're in the restaurant talking about the birds, when they first go in and they're talking about the birds before the birds attack outside, and Melanie and Mitch are trying to warn everybody, look, all the kids at the school just got attacked. I think they're trying to kill them. In the background, the waitress is calling in orders to the cook, and she's like, three southern fried chickens, right? Or two Bloody Marys. Like, there's all these mentions of birds and blood are just thrown in the background. It's hilarious.
I didn't notice that. That's awesome.
And like you, the high shot to me above the town is my favorite, one of my favorite shots in any movie. And I think the reason it works so much for me is that you're seeing it, one, from the bird's eye view, but there's no birds in the shot. And you only hear the wind. And it gives you an emotional break from Melanie's point of view. We have experienced most of this movie from her point of view. And there's been this escalation of attacks against her and the people around her. So there's this right at the midpoint of the movie where you're really, it's like a roller coaster. At some point, you just need to coast for a little bit, right? So at this point of the ride.
Constantly going up. It's like the Tower of Babel.
So at this point in the story, we need a break. And that's one thing that really effective storytellers have to do, is they have to give their readers or their audience an emotional break. So he gives us this high shot where it's just breezy and nice. And even though you're watching it, you're seeing again the geography of the town, but you're now visually and emotionally removed from it. You're now a spectator. For the first time in the movie, you're now passively watching this movie.
You're actually slightly in the perspective of the birds.
Well, you are. But I mean, it's so high in a way from the, people are like ants, right? So you're just, you're emotionally disconnected for a minute.
Yeah.
And it's, and you need that. You're like, oh my gosh, this has been intense. And then the seagulls coast into the frame and you're like, oh crap, it's only going to get worse. So he gives you this detached emotional break. And then he's like, yeah, but I'm Hitchcock. So enjoy it while it lasts, because now it's only going to get worse. And I think that's why I love that scene so much, because emotionally you're like, oh my gosh, just get me out of this for a minute. Just for a minute. And he gives you about 10 seconds. And again, I think you're left with the question, are all these attacks about Melanie by the end of this act? Okay, now we go to the final act of the story. Mitch and Melanie go back to get Kathy at Annie's house. When the attack at the restaurant occurred, Annie sacrificed herself by pushing Kathy into the house before the birds overwhelmed Annie and killed her in her front yard. Her eyes are also gone. And the way Hitchcock shot, that's interesting because you don't see it. It's profile of her face, but Mitch covers so you can't see that her eyes are gone.
Yeah, which gives her a little bit of dignity that the farmer wasn't given.
Yes, right. Annie's a more important character to the story. As they walk Kathy back to Melanie's car, which is still near the schoolhouse, the playground, power lines, and school are again covered with black crows. So you're like, uh-oh. It's only a minute. Like, be quiet. Don't make a noise. At 93 minutes, they are back at Mitch's family's home, and they're boarding up the house, awaiting for the next inevitable attack. And now you know it's inevitable. And I think that's the dread part. I think all dread really comes from inevitable badness.
Yeah, that's you know a good what I mean? Point. Yeah, because if you don't know something's going to happen, you're tense, but it's really the...
You can't escape it. It's inescapable threats.
Yeah.
The bird attacks are coming more often, and they don't think they can make it all the way to San Francisco without getting attacked. So they're going to board up the house and wait until morning. And while boarding up the house, they see birds heading away from Bodega Bay and moving inland. Perhaps the bird war is spreading. The radio mentions the attacks in passing, but they don't express the danger. At this point, Lydia cracks, and she tells Mitch, if only your father was here. And then she apologizes. And now they wait. They're in this house. It's all boarded up. The tension builds. And silence, which was comforting, is now the enemy because it's preceding the inevitable danger.
The thing that is so interesting to me about what Hitch does as a director is that he keeps swapping the characters and the audience's perspective, because now, kind of for the first time, the characters are doing what the audience has been doing, which is waiting for a bird attack.
Right, and cowering. And what's really interesting is the noise outside occurs of the bird attack. They react to nothing. There's nothing in the house. The birds haven't made it in, but because of their experiences of being attacked, they're all reacting as if the birds are attacking them and cowering against the couch or cowering in the corner just by the sound. And the sound, again, is synthesized bird noise, and it's just uncomfortable, and it sounds a little evil, honestly. While they're waiting, though, Lydia tries to act normal, moving dishes from the coffee table and into the kitchen. And with Lydia broken, Melanie is left to confront a frightened Kathy. So Melanie kind of replaces Lydia in that moment. At 100 minutes, the lovebirds in the kitchen start chirping. And a moment later, the birds begin their attack outside.
Canary in a coal mine.
Yes. Yeah. That's such a good analogy, and it just caught me by surprise, and we've been talking about birds all these time. What is wrong with me? All right, so there's no dialogue for 5 minutes of film time. Loud bird chirps, and the sound of their massive attack is all we hear, and they react to nothing. One of the creepiest scenes is the birds are pecking through the front wooden door, and you can just see the holes starting to form and these bills pecking through the hole. And Hitchcock does this very Spielberg, or Spielberg does a Hitchcock shot of the slow dolly in towards, and it's like this inevitable, someone needs to address this, right? And then
look over here.
Look over here, people. And then they're also trying to break through the window, and Mitch is trying to secure the windows, or is they're attacking his hands and he's getting bloody.
Man, that, what was it, 1960s fake blood?
Oh, yeah, it does not play well.
It's rough.
At 105 minutes, a bird is heard crying out, apparently electrocuting itself, and the lights go out. And then moments later, the attack stops. Later, everyone is asleep, but Melanie hears bird fluttering coming from the second floor. She goes upstairs to investigate. She opens the bedroom door to find a window shattered, a hole in the roof, and the room filled with birds. At 107 minutes, just 2 minutes after the attack ended, but it feels longer because it's peaceful and you're emotionally drained, the birds begin to attack her relentlessly. As she fights them off, she gets pressed against the door and can't escape. She eventually succumbs to the attack, unconscious as the birds peck at her flesh, until Mitch pushes open the door and pulls her outside.
And there are two really significant things to me as a woman watching this film that I observed. One is that the attack is almost completely silent. With all of the other attacks, the birds are loud. They're cawing,
right,
and crowing.
True.
in that scene, all you hear is the fluttering of wings. So it's
so
loud.
True. I never thought about that.
But it's not, they're not saying anything. They're just attacking her. And the other is that, like, as a woman, I'm sensitive to the fact that the attack takes place in a bedroom. That's a thing that maybe not men who have watched the film would have noticed, but I'm pretty sure every woman who watched the film was sensitive to that.
Also, because of the history of eye plucking, which I think is, everyone's horrified, like, instinctively. I don't think anyone would go, yeah, that's okay. Like, instinctively, like, stay away from my eyes, right? So there's always this threat, like, especially when she's unconscious, you're like, oh my gosh, they're going to pluck out her eyes. It's an established threat that you fear for her. After the attack, Mitch and Lydia bandage her up, and when Melanie opens her eyes, she's in a state of shock, still thinking she's being attacked, and she's kind of lost it at this point. She's mentally checked out.
She held it together for a really long time.
What Mitch was unable to do, the birds finally did. They beat her. They have to get her to a hospital. And Mitch takes the chance of going to the detached garage to see if her car is undamaged because it's the fastest. As he leaves the house, his yard, power lines, tree branches, and rooftops are covered with birds as far as he could see. He slowly walks his way from the porch to the garage, annoyed gulls pecking at him as he passes by. Which is kind of terrifying because you think one peck could turn into a million. He gets into the garage, which is bird-free, turns on the radio, and hears of bird attacks beyond Bodega Bay. Lydia cares for Melanie as a mother would her daughter, and they escort Melanie to the car. She freaks out at the sight of the birds, but they calm her and get her into the car.
Which is fair, you know, like...
yeah, understandable.
Understandable.
But what's so great
where
about...
Where she walks out, she's like, no!
But what's so great about that is that you totally get it. Again, a great twist by Hitchcock of saying, of course this woman's going to react this way. Of course she's going to say that, but you're literally surrounded by the most birds you've ever seen in the movie. And you're like, we need to be quiet. And she screams. Kathy brings the caged lovebirds with her, which is interesting because at 114 minutes, they drive away slowly through the bird-covered roads. And as they leave, the birds seem to chirp in victory. So what's interesting about that is it about Melanie or is it about the caged birds?
Well, if you look at the film and what Hitch does visually, the opening shot, not the opening shot, but the opening scene takes place in a pet store.
Right.
So there are caged birds everywhere. And literally for the rest of the film, it is the humans that are caged in restaurants, in phone booths, in cars. And the birds are the ones that are free. So is it about the caged birds? I've also heard people say that the birds are a manifestation of the brokenness of the relationships in between this thing. I've heard them say it's about Melanie being a disruptive force in society. I've heard people say it's about Lydia attacking anyone who tries to disturb her nest and her family. And so in that case, are the birds letting them pass because Melanie and Lydia have resolved the tension in their relationship? Or are the birds letting them pass because they've won victory over the land? Is it about man's hubris and thinking that they can control nature and the birds being like, no, you're wrong, you know?
Right. The great thing is he doesn't answer it. Again, as I talked about before, the most surprising element in that last climactic act is how much Hitchcock uses silence as they wait for the next attack. And when Mitch goes to the garage to get Melanie's car, there's no music, there's no talking, just ominous clucks of birds all around them. And what's interesting, too, about Annie's death is that it closes the door on her and Mitch's relationship. Mm-hmm. And it opens the door for Melanie and Mitch.
And it's interesting, too, because when you meet Annie, she describes herself as an open book. Then she says, actually, a closed one. And the film ends with her book ending.
Right. Also, in this last act, after showing you of what all the birds were capable of, Hitchcock again plays with the audience's expectation. The final battle is as much a mental war as it is a physical one. They're boarded up within the house when the final attack occurs. And even though they're not in the house, it's the most suspenseful because you know what would happen if they made it inside. As we talked about, you see the characters react to the sound as much as they would if they were being attacked. And again, the power of synthesized bird sound is especially effective in this act. It's twisted. Again, it gives the intent of malevolence. There's one other thing that I love about this act.
Just one.
The shot of Melanie going up the stairs.
Because it reminds you of Psycho?
Yes, it's the same shot. So Melanie goes up the stairs. Everyone's asleep. She's on the couch with holding Kathy. And she hears fluttering upstairs. So she goes up the stairs. And he has this shot where he just stays at her level up the stairs. The camera travels as if it were on the banister. And again, it's really uncomfortable because you want to see what she's going to see. And it's shot in a way, the same way it is in Psycho, that the shot itself is uncomfortable. I don't know how to explain it. It is so full of suspense because of what he allows you to see and what he doesn't see, and how the camera so smoothly follows up, focusing on her and her face. And you're like, oh my gosh, I want to see what you're going to see. I want to see what you're going to see. And you just know.
And it's almost like Hitch, who frames things very well, but it's almost like he does it intentionally. It's like, I know you want to see this, but I'm going to move the camera over an inch or something like that.
Or change the angle slightly. Before I go to the scenes that every thriller must have, any final thoughts about The Birds?
Well, it's interesting. I really enjoy Hitch's films because he tells a story cinematically. And I chose that word very specifically because it's not always the best scripts and it's not always the best acting choices with some of his other films. I think this one is very good. But he tells a story visually very well, and I appreciate that. Well, one of the things that's so fascinating to me, as much as I really do enjoy this movie, is that I don't think it's his best film.
Oh, no, I don't think so either.
And I don't think it's one of his most rewatchable films, though it's one of his most iconic films. And as I was rewatching it for this podcast, a thought occurred to me about another film that we've seen recently where it's very silent and people trying to survive. And what movie is that?
That's The Quiet Place.
A Quiet Place. And as I was comparing these two, it occurred to me very early in the film. And so as I was comparing these two, one of the reasons I think that, to me personally, A Quiet Place is more rewatchable and resonates more deeply with me is because the themes in The Birds seem to be a commentary. They seem to be very intellectual. They're a commentary on women. They're an allegory for war. They're very fascinating and very interesting to discuss, which is why we've done this podcast.
Right.
But they're not something that everybody can resonate with. Whereas a family trying to survive is something that everybody can resonate with, you know? And I think that that is why that film, as much as I have a hard time comparing them because, you know, this is a classic film and The Quiet Place, while it's very good, is not a Hollywood classic.
And also shot in very different studio styles from the time.
Very different studio styles. I think that the underlying themes resonate more deeply in A Quiet Place, which is something that I think is actually missing from The Birds. As interesting as the themes are, I don't think they affect the audience in a way that stays with them.
The thing about Hitchcock movies is not every movie is rewatchable, but every movie has a must-see scene. So the last thing I want to talk about is that every genre has expectations that the writer must fulfill in order for it to be considered a success. In thrillers, there's seven things that every film should have. And what's interesting for The Birds being such a good thriller, doesn't have a clear fulfillment of these requirements. Every thriller has to have an inciting incident. Every story needs to have one. And of course,
no, most people just meander throughout.
Just like, I don't know, we'll figure out what the story's about 30 minutes in. But in The Birds, it begins with a flirtatious give and take between the main characters and ends with the attack on Melanie on the boat. The second thing is a MacGuffin. And Hitchcock explains a MacGuffin as this is the focus of the story from the character's point of view, but it's not the focus of the storyteller. So for The Birds, why the birds are attacking is the MacGuffin. It doesn't matter in the end because the real story, from Hitchcock's perspective, is about Melanie and Mitch's relationship and her entry into that close-knit family. So the MacGuffin is the thing that all the characters are trying to solve, but is not what the story is about. Red herrings are a necessary item in thrillers, and these are plot tangents that give the audience or reader a false potential path or paths toward a solution. And The Birds, it's not really clear, as many other thrillers, but I guess the various characters coming up with alternatives as to what it is, biblical, whatever, that may be red herrings. What's really interesting here is one of the things that's required in thrillers, and you see this all the time in movies, is a speech in praise of the villain. So this is where you're about to go after Joe Bad Guy, and you're like, man, I don't know, he's tough. He's got a million like soldiers, and he's really smart. He's got all this money, and it sets up the threat. Well, The Birds, no one knows what the hell's going on, right? So I think of The Birds, this role is sloppily handled by the ornithologist.
I would agree.
She talks about the value of the birds in nature and their impressive numbers and how we wouldn't have a chance in hell if they all worked against us. So I think that's the speech in praise of a villain piece. The next piece is the stakes have to become personal. It compels now the protagonist to see the story through to the end, right? Like, why don't they just leave? Well, they just attacked all the kids in school. Why don't you get out of town? We have to solve this problem or we're all dead. It becomes personal at some point. And also Mitch and Melanie have information that no one else really believes, is that the birds have evil intent. And so they can't leave and let these people who don't believe that be attacked when they know better. One other is a hero at the mercy of the villain. And this is where the protagonist is usually held captive by the villain, holding their life in their hands, and then they escape somehow. But this is funny, is that the birds, we don't really have that moment. Not that clearly defined. The best example is when they attack the house, flying through the fireplace and swarming Melanie and Mitch and the family, and at the very end when they're trying to walk through all the birds. It's the only time where they are surrounded by birds in a way that they can't control. Other times they can fight it or hide, but there's no time where, you know, the bad guy has the gun at the hero's head going, "You're mine." And then the good guy finally gets out of it. And the last thing is every thriller has a false ending. Thrillers always have two endings, the one where the main character beats the villain, followed by surprise information or a vague threat that is still outstanding.
Hmm.
Yeah, for the birds, the film ends with a massive bird attack where they boarded up their house and have barely survived. The second ending is when Melanie goes upstairs to check on the noises and attacked. Or you could combine those two as the house attack. And the open question is, are they going to keep attacking? Is this only going to get worse? Does it end now? It could be the impending threat of future bird attacks, or you could split those two attacks into that. At the end of a thriller, you want more. It's not a mystery where you want to know the answer. At the end of a thriller, you want the hero to win, but you don't want the ride to be over.
Did Hitch really do false endings, though, with any of his films? He normally did false beginnings. So, like, a lot of his stories had a beginning that you thought was the story, and then things change.
Yeah, at plot point one, it changes into something you did not expect
completely
at all.
Completely different. Like,
whether
not
it's Psycho or Rear Window or anything like that, right?
Yes.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I don't know. This is the first time I've looked at these seven characteristics at a Hitchcock movie and tried to apply them. So I'll do that with when we do future Hitchcock stuff, which I'm sure we will. I'll try to apply them because that's a good question. I don't know. I would think probably not. I don't know if it was as clearly defined back then as it is now, or if he just didn't care.
Yeah, that's really what was going through my mind, because he would film a movie in his head and then he made it. But while he was making it, he would think about the next movie he was filming
his head. He was bored shooting a movie because he'd already shot it in his head.
When he was done, he was done. He's like, no false endings. Let's just wrap this up.
Well, also, you know, people who are master storytellers in any medium, they know the rules and they choose to break them for a specific reason or ignore them. And he's such a good story. Obviously, he knows what he's doing. So if he chooses to ignore it, it's either because of a lack of interest or because it doesn't add value to the story in his mind. But I'm curious to see how these apply going forward.
We'll have to pay attention when we dive back into the Hitchcock film library.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. All right, so this was The Birds, and it was extensive and detailed, but I think this is the only way you can really go and effectively talk about really good stories when it comes to plot and character. You really need to break it down act by act and kind of see how the story was constructed.
So thank you guys for joining us. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you have any thoughts or comments you'd like to share with us, please do so below.
And also, if you want a movie or series of movies or stories, books, whatever, that you want us to look at from a plot and character perspective, let us know and we will add it to our list. Thanks for joining us. I'm author Pete Bauer.
And I'm Baby Falcon, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.